Prabhupada Paramahamsa Parivrajakacharyas, Dr. Satya Shishimara Swami Vishala Bhakti Siddhanta Sarasati Goswami Srila Prabhupada. Science of the Mind. I'd just like to read the translation of the bhajan, since this is one of my favorite. Lord Gauranga is calling, "Wake up, sleeping souls, wake up, sleeping souls. You have slept so long on the lap of the witch Maya. You come into this world of birth and death saying, 'My Lord, I will certainly worship you,' but you have forgotten your promise and remained in great ignorance. I have descended just to save you. Except for me, who is your friend? I have brought the medicine to eradicate the disease of illusion. Now pray for this Harinam Maha Mantra and take it." Thakur Bhaktivinoda falls at the lotus feet of Lord Gauranga, and after begging for the holy name, he receives that Maha Mantra. Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur ki jai, Sri Gauranga Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Sankirtan ISKCON Worldwide Movement ki jai, Srila Prabhupada ki jai. So, thank you all for coming. First of all is, first of all is that I have cleared two who did these examinations yesterday, and yourself should remain after the class. Just talk with you shortly about your test. That's you're Nimai Gaur, and you are... Oh, you're Nimai Gaur. And you're Jean-Claude Charest. Okay. All right. Nimai Gaur, Jean-Claude Charest. So the two of you stay. And Pandava also, I need to talk to you too afterwards. Okay. So as we said, our policy will be to open with questions. If you have any questions on yesterday's class that you've been nursing overnight. These are important questions. We'll take them this time. If not, no questions?
Come on.
If there are no questions, then we'll just move on. So, Nitai Gauranga Prabhu is going to continue talking about Freudian drive theory. Of course, this is Freud's theory, but actually, Srila Prabhupada, although he spoke very strongly against Freud for being so atheistic and for seeming to he propagated throughout the world a seeming solution to human problems that was totally devoid of any reference to God. In fact, it was purposefully, Freud's purpose was to overturn religion with his system of psychoanalysis. So although Prabhupada has flung many lightning bolts against Freud for that, there's one aspect of Freudian theory that Prabhupada readily acknowledged, and that is this drive theory that ultimately everything in the material world, that not only human beings but all living entities are doing, is based upon sexual attraction, the sex drive. So I'll turn the floor over now to Nitai Gauranga to proceed.
Are we sure no one has any questions about Freud whatsoever that they want to just throw out? It's okay, really. Everyone understands what we went through yesterday with the map of the mind, with the conscious, unconscious, id, ego, superego. Everyone's got it. Okay. I was planning on backtracking a bit and talking about a little bit of the history of how Freud came to these theories, because I think it's quite interesting. Freud actually wasn't trained as a psychologist. I guess there was no real psychological training formally in those days. He was actually trained as a neurologist. And in the course of being a neurologist, there is a phenomenon that was known in those days as hysteria, which literally means a floating womb, floating uterus. That the original belief was that it only happened in women, of course, and the uterus would get detached and float around the body and would cause erratic behavior. I think by that time, by Freud's time even, it was suspected that wasn't exactly what was going on. But anyway, hysteria was, and it was actually acknowledged that it happened probably more in men than women, although men didn't like to admit it so much. But hysteria just being erratic and illogical behavior. So neurologists came across this quite often because, well, not quite often, but from time to time, they would come across what they call glove anesthesia, that someone would come in, we would have no feeling in their hand, and say, "Doctor, I have no feeling in my hand." So the doctor would immediately, you know, poke around the arm in certain places, and "Do you feel this?" "Yeah, I feel that, I feel that." Well, the nerves in the arm are connected to the nerves in the hand, so there's really no way that there can be no feeling in the hand and at the same time be feeling in the arm. So this isn't a neurological problem, this was a psychological problem. So through the influence of Dr. Charcot in France, Freud began using the treatment of hypnosis with patients who had hysteria. And the process of bringing people under hypnosis, he found that people would often bring up, under hypnosis, would bring up conflicts that they were having or traumas that happened earlier in life. These would be the first things to kind of come out of the hypnotic state. And that as they went through the process of talking about their traumatic experience and even reliving it to an extent with the concomitant emotional reactions to those experiences, that the symptoms of hysteria would diminish and they would feel better, and the glove anesthesia would also often leave, and their hysterical symptoms would often leave. And so from there, Freud began to think, I guess we could say, think about things psychologically. When I say think of things psychologically, that means to try to consider something beyond superficial explanations of things. So in the example of glove anesthesia, when you see that there's no superficial explanation, it's not a nervous thing, that actually there is something much deeper going on than that. That's what it means to think psychologically. And in Freud's case, what he considered thinking psychologically is to somehow make unconscious content, things that are in the unconscious mind, how to make them conscious, how to make the people aware of it, how to dig into someone's unconscious and recover what the conflict or the trauma that is ailing the person, that's causing the person's erratic behavior. And so Freud eventually moved away from hypnosis because, one, he wasn't a very good hypnotist. He couldn't bring many people under. He wasn't very good at it. And two, and probably more importantly, in that time, the climate was very, trying to claim psychology as a rational science. And Freud once said that hypnosis just seems too mystical. So it couldn't be considered a hard science if you were going about it through hypnosis. So he discarded with hypnosis and instead went to what he called free association. So free association means the patient, or in this case they're called the analysand. The analysand makes an effort not to censor anything that will come out. So you say, what's the first thing that comes to your mind? and the analysis will say whatever the analysis will say. And if it's uncensored, if the person is not making an effort to hide things, then the unconscious content, specifically the unconscious content that has direct relation to the person's ailment, will become manifest. And through the process of the analyst confronting that and making interpretations of that content, that the person becomes aware of the conflict or the trauma that was previously giving them problems. And so in that way, the person becomes self-aware of their issues, of how their mind works, and consequently, they're able to work through these issues that previously were pushed down into the unconscious mind because they were too difficult to deal with. And then, besides free association, and probably more importantly, Freud used a process that he referred to as an analysis of transference. Transference, we can say, is in one sense it means how one person relates to another. So in this case, how the analysin relates to the analyst, the analyst. But not just how they relate, but how they relate in ways that are illogical or are pathological, we can say. In the sense that they are taking content from their previous trauma, which they are generally unaware of, and they are placing that onto the analyst. So they're in a sense, they're superimposing their past onto this person in the present, and their general style of dealing with people is to place the emotional baggage that came with that conflict or that trauma, and to place it on the external world. And I guess I could illustrate this with some experiences that I've had in my work as a counselor in the psychiatric hospital. First one is quite a simple one. There was one boy. He was 15 years old and very well built, athletic. you know, he was actually on a regional basketball team that would travel actually around the whole country and play. You know, he was one of the best players, best high school basketball players in his region, or actually in the state. So, you know, he had a lot of promise for getting a scholarship, going to a university, et cetera, et cetera. But he started smoking a lot of marijuana. And marijuana, I've seen, has different effects on some people, but some people, very quickly, it makes them, you know, very absent-minded. And this is what happened to him. So he was smoking marijuana for about a month, and he began forgetting plays when he was playing basketball, and he wouldn't know where to go, what to do, and the coach was noticing it and telling him, you've really got to get it together, or you're going to be off the team. And so he fell into a deep depression, ended up in the psychiatric hospital. And I saw him in the year that I worked there. He came in four times, and he was a really, really tough character. Really built and very intimidating and very threatening at times. And by the fourth time he came in, his grandmother told me something. He lived with his grandmother. His grandmother told me that he had seen one of his best friends get shot just recently. And actually, over the period of the 3 months that he was out of the hospital, five of his friends were killed. He lived in actually one of the most crime-ridden neighborhoods in America. It was right outside of Boston.
Roxbury?
No, Dorchester.
No.
Okay. Roxbury is like the second.
Number two.
Yeah. Okay. Dorchester. So, this time, I mean, I had a little bit more to go on, and on why he acted the way he did. He was very, with everyone, very tough, and really put up a wall with like his strength and the intimidation factor that he would just spread all over the place. And so the one day I really, really challenged him, and I. Anyway, it was funny the way I went about it. He was being quite a problem, and I made the point that, you know, you're trying to act tough, but I really see that ultimately you're just scared. You're afraid of something. And he kept walking away when I was saying it, and then I knew, wow, I'm really onto something. So I said, come on, so-and-so. I don't want to reveal his name, obviously, but so-and-so, let's talk, come on. And he kept walking away, and I said, you're afraid of me, aren't you? And he kept walking away, and then at the end of the night, he came to me, because I kept confronting him like this. You're afraid of me, because you know that I know something about you. And the end of the night, he came to me and he spoke to me, and he told me the stories about his friends getting shot, and you know, the last one was one of his best friends that he grew up with, and he got shot right in front of him and died right in front of him. And telling me how he's 15, you know, he has to walk around his neighborhood with his hand inside his jacket because he has a gun on him at all times. This is a true story. Actually, he came to the hospital because his grandmother found him playing Russian roulette in his room, just taking the gun, spinning the chamber, and pulling the trigger. So when he, you know, started revealing all this, he really, the toughness broke down, and he really, really became very upset, and just admitted to me how afraid he is that it's going to happen to him, how afraid he is to live in that neighborhood, and how afraid he is that he's going to turn out to be like his brother, who was a drug dealer, ended up in jail. He's afraid. He just, you know, he saw that he had so much potential, that he could go to school for playing basketball, and he blew it. And now he's afraid that he's going to have a similar fate as his brother, which is ending up in jail, like so many people that he knew, or dead, like some of his friends. So the transference, you know, this toughness was really a way to defend against the past, that he was actually feeling very, very vulnerable, and he needed to convince himself that it wasn't going to happen to him, that he was strong enough, he was stronger than the rest of his friends, he was stronger than his brother, and it wasn't going to happen to him. So, it's one example. The second one I have, it's hard to say what the purport of this one is, but this is a woman, she was older, she was probably around my age. This is on the adult unit, and I worked on the adult unit a couple times this when she was there. And she hated every woman that worked there, just furious, just would see them, would just be really upset with them. And any male, she would follow around and just, like, literally, like, would stand, like, I'm standing here, she would stand here behind me, like, to my side, and just, you know, you turn, and it's, like, awkward, you turn around, you smile, hello, so-and-so, how are you today? And she would just smile and look at you. And then she would do this, and then after, you know, she would do that for maybe a couple hours. And then one time you'd say, oh, hello, so-and-so. And she would just stare you dead in the face and say, you know, why are you trying to ruin my effing life, you know, and just be furious with you. But it's interesting because she had this reaction only with males. With females, she just hated, but she had some sort of attachment and at the same time aversion to all males. So she would follow them around, like, you know, right, you know, like shadow you, and then just be furious with you once you acknowledged her presence. So I'm not exactly sure what the purport is for that, but that was just an interesting example of transference. Now the third one is probably this is like textbook stuff, and I swear I didn't make this up. This is really interesting. There was one girl, she was, I think, 16, and she The kids, and to pass the time, they would make these little beaded necklaces, and some of them had letters on them, so they would make, you know, necklaces or bracelets with their names on it, or, you know, it was some and we would often find ones with, you know, unpleasantries written on them. And so she was one such person that had, I'm sorry for the language, I think the word slut written on her. On her necklace, and I made
everyone know what that means. It's prostitute.
Yeah.
It's a very low class word for prostitute.
So she had this word written, and I said, "You know, it's an interesting necklace you have there." And anyway, we were just. This is the first time I interacted with her, and so. She was acting out very sexually towards every male, you know, especially the younger males, but also just her way of interacting was very, very sexual, like, you know, explicitly sexual with all the males. And the first time I was speaking with her, I was asking her, I can't remember how we got on the topic, but she was telling me about a boyfriend that she had that I think was 26 or 27 years old. She was 16. And she was telling me how much sex they have. And I said, "Do you think he really cares about you?" And she says, "No." And I said, "Do you think that's really going to make you happy?" And just kind of going through the whole thing, I don't think relationships like this are going to ultimately make you happy, and you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And she responded to them, you know, anyway, whatever. You know, she was kind of, you know, understood the point, but wasn't really so interested. And then the last day I met with her, she was leaving the next morning. And I said to her, I said, "What are you going to do? What's the first thing you're going to do when you get out?" You know, because she had been there for 3 weeks, so it's often, you know, they feel a little deprived, et cetera, et cetera. I said, "What's the first thing you're going to do when you get out?" She said, "I'm probably going to have sex." And I was thinking, my initial reaction is to say, "You know, why do you have to do that? You know, you've got a lot going for you, yada, yada, yada." But instead, I had a professor who was actually a Freudian. That's my last semester in school. And she made the point that when someone is acting out their transference, you don't react to it, but you question it, or you try to interpret it, or you try to confront it. And so instead of reacting like, "That's not going to make you happy, I think that's really unsafe behavior, you should really be concerned for yourself," instead of that, I asked her, I said, how did I word it? I said, "What response are you looking for when you ask me that question? When you tell me that, when you give me that response to the question, what's the response you're looking for?" And she told me, "I want you to tell me to not do it." So, and after she told me that, which I was floored when she actually, that kind of fell out of her mouth, and she was a little shocked that she even said that herself. Kind of just spilled out, "I want you to tell me not to do it." And after that, she continued to tell me that she had a pretty significant history of sexual abuse when she was growing up. And ultimately, she didn't phrase it like this, but the phenomenon is generally like this, that when someone is a victim of sexual abuse, that they'll become very overtly sexual, and on their own terms, they like to think of it. On their own terms, because they want to take the situation that was made so wrong for them, that this difficult experience with sexual contact, and they want to make it right. So they often become very overtly sexual, very flirtatious, you know, etc. So anyway, those were three interesting examples I had of transference. And really, I would say that's really, in a nutshell, that's the Freudian drive theory and the Freudian theory of transference. And I think it exemplifies how to think psychologically. How to look underneath the superficial coverings of the pathology or the illness, what have you, the disintegration, how to understand what's pushing underneath it, what's driving those behaviors, what's driving those thought processes, etc. And so really, I think, although Freud's theories are widely criticized, etc., he did lay this foundation of having a very a unified vision of personality, what causes pathology in a person, and consequently how one can be healed. And really exemplify this idea of thinking psychologically, thinking deeper than looking at surface issues. And though his ideas weren't necessarily agreed with by everyone, I think he was really emblematic in doing that, in creating a unified theory of personality psychopathology and therapy, and also in thinking psychologically. So that's the introductory to Western psychology always starts with Freud. So there you have it. Is that clear? Is there any questions? Yes.
I was just wondering, like, what I was mentioning yesterday, that Schober was called Freud one of the three big demons.
Yeah.
And what would be specific, fault in his approach with disqualifying whatever being the
Acharya.
Yeah.
I would say. One thing is that he propounded a lot of theories of religion that weren't, necessarily favorable. not even comparing, but considering religious activity to be a form of neurosis, and that these people are trying to fulfill certain. There's drives underneath the religious activity. There's nothing genuine about it. Further, he propounded a worldview that man is not a rational character. Previously it was held that man is rational, so he kind of flipped that idea on his head that man is irrational, which when people speak of the greatest proponents of atheism or postmodern thought, that he is one of the main six, and I can't remember all six of them. But that's really the shift from the Darwinian idea of progression, where before humans were considered to be digressing, and Darwin flipped it around, saying no, humans are progressing, which changed things around, changed modern thought quite drastically, and then. Freud's contribution with that was that man is not rational, man is irrational, so flipping that. That's as far as I can say. I'm not much of a philosopher. Maybe you have more as to why Prabhupada had such sweet things to say to Freud.
Yeah, to get back on the anti-religious point, he proposed that the idea of God came simply from our, everyone's relationship with their father.
Right.
So God is just a kind of metaphysical, mental projection of our relationship with our father. And it's not healthy because we should grow up and become independent of our parents. And so similarly, we should give up this God idea because it's just... And just to elaborate on the point he made that... religious behavior is neurotic. So he would say that when we every morning reach for our beads and chant 16 rounds, that there's some crazy people who are always washing their hands. It's the same. It's exactly the same type of behavior. We're just crazy and have to chant on our beads over and over again because something's wrong up here. And another thing is I read... some Freud, and I read also where he made comments about Indian yogis. And they were also extremely negative. Extremely. The yogis who... not a lot was known in Europe at that time about yoga. They were just discovering it. But anyway, he was really making a mockery of the whole thing. Because it was enough was known in Europe by that time that yoga was a Eastern form of... It's understood in the West in this way, the Indian, traditional Indian form of psychology, dealing, of calming the mind. Yoga mainly works, dhyana yoga, to fix the mind through meditation. And all the practices, yam, yam, asan, pranayam, pratyahara, they're all ultimately aimed at gaining control over the mind and calming a person. And he was just saying really, really extremely negative things about the whole concept of yoga. And he didn't, I've never read that he knew anything about bhakti yoga, I really doubt it. But you could include bhakti yoga into, because he was talking about yoga in general. And bhakti, in our bhakti yoga system, I've studied this, that there is for everything that's in the Astanga Yoga system, there is an equivalent that we do. We give it, it's a different name, and of course we engage in activities rather than ultimately trying to stop the senses. But there is an equivalent. So he certainly would have not appreciated the Hare Krishna movement if it had manifest during his time. And another thing, of course this, as I came to understand from a god brother of mine who was working on an MA, I told you about him. An MA, he had also gotten a BA in psychology and almost got an MA before he went into something else, went into business or something. But he's, having been trained, and he is also that type of person who's very psychoanalytical. And, he told me this was actually a mistranslation of Freud's original German into English. But anyway, at least in the English-speaking world, which of course the English-speaking world is the most influential, culturally influential part of the world. And in the United States, and you were saying yesterday, in England Freud is still big, yeah. But Freud was very big in the United States up through the 40s, and in the 50s it started to slack off, but from the early part of the 20th century, for 50 years at least in the US, Freud was king. He was really, really the dominant figure. And so in English-speaking countries, the Freud's term, I don't know what it was in the original German, but his term for the ideal personality, you know, the one who's worked out through all his neuroses and is as sane as a person can possibly be. In the English translated books, the term was genital personality. Personality was totally, you know, at ease with his sex desire and, you know, has no, you know, neurosis about it. And Freud's philosophy, his whole... It's not necessarily that he himself was the advocate of what, in my, you know, as I was growing up, came to be known as free love. You know, in other words, just free expression of sexuality. Not necessarily that he would openly advocate, but the logic of his psychological system does very strongly lead in that direction, because he talks about pent up, you know, sex desire, and it's very unhealthy. And then because of this mistranslation, you know, the ideal person is a genital personality.
But even so, he's considered one of the main, his theories were one of the main thrusts behind the sexual revolution,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
But genital person really refers to someone who has gone through the other psychosexual stages, which it's pain to go through and complex and really doesn't make much sense if you ask me. But has the genital stage was the last stage, so he kind of went through the other ones without being conflicted. So it doesn't necessarily mean someone who is in touch with their genitals or something, but it means someone who has gone up to that stage and is, you know, as an integrated person,
yeah,
without conflicts, etc.
But what I read in, I had a book, dictionary, something like Dictionary of Freudian Terms, and they used that term, and the way it was explained was a person who is no longer conflicted about sexuality.
Right.
So in other words, he's sexually, in exactly what that means, sexually free of hang-ups, is not really, was not made clear, but you know, those who would read those terms, that sort of terminology and that underlying flow of thinking, would easily come to the conclusion that a psychologically healthy person just has sex whenever he wants to with anybody he wants to. That's, you know, just freely express it, don't hold it back, because it will screw you up the more you hold it back. And yes, it's a fact that whether or not Freud, because I from what I read about Freud, he was also a pretty puritanical person himself. In his own life.
In his own practice,
yeah,
sure.
In his own life, he was not the acharya of that sort of, but just the,
he was
his own. He had a lot of problems. My friend, my godbrother, told me actually from his he was fascinated with Freud and went very, very deep into studying his, not only his philosophy or, you know, approach to psychology, but his life. And he said, if ever there was a crazy person, it was Freud. He himself was a really very disturbed person. Mm. And that's why many, like, I think the chief example is Jung, Carl Gustav Jung, whom Prabhupada commented, of all the philosophers that were summed up to him in that, when Prabhupada was discussing Western philosophy with Shyamasundara Prabhu and Hayagriva Prabhu.
Didactic spiritualism.
Hmm?
Didactic spiritualism.
Yeah, dialectical spiritualism. So all the philosophers from beginning of, you know, the Greeks till modern times, Prabhupada made the comment that Jung was the most sensible, because Jung, he rejected Freud for being an atheist and being so much obsessed with sex. You know, he just thought this is too much, you know. Although he started off as a disciple, and then he branched off, and in Jungian psychology it does. There's a lot of resonance, and Jung also wrote about yoga, and he was not totally sympathetic to it, but he was much more sympathetic, much more, you know, open to ideas coming from India than Freud was. Freud was definitely very Western, very and all, very Germanic in his approach. You know, his very square, narrow categories, and Nietzschean also. He was. It's said that he was, where you pointed, that man is ultimately irrational. That he was very. He got that from Friedrich Nietzsche, who ended up himself a madman for the last 10 years of his life. He was locked up in Sil Saint Maria in Switzerland, in an insane asylum. He just totally went crazy. So he became, Nietzsche was a real acharya of his own philosophy. Man is irrational because he went insane. And Freud was very, because of the Nietzsche wrote in German, and Freud was German speaker, Austrian. So he was very influenced by that. And Nietzsche is another one. You know, he's the first Western philosophy who openly stuck his finger in the air and proclaimed God is dead. The first one who dared just say it openly like that. You know, God is dead. So he must have been one of the other six.
Yeah. I can't remember all.
You were mentioning. So anyway, I'd like to continue. Getting back to the Bhagavata science of mind, here's a quotation I cited from this purport before, and now continuing from the same purport. This is Canto 3, Chapter 28, verse number 7. So in the purport, Srila Prabhupada would write, Etair Anyaischa. The general yoga process entails observing the rules and regulations, practicing different sitting postures, concentrating the mind on the vital circulation of the air, and then thinking of the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his Vaikuntha pastimes. This is the general process of yoga. The same concentration can be achieved by other recommended processes, and therefore, anyaischa, other methods, and this is from the original verse spoken by Lord Kapiladev, can also be applied. The essential point is that the mind, which is contaminated by material attraction, has to be bridled and concentrated on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So, bridling the mind, because, you see, basically there are two sides when we talk about coming to terms with the mind as devotees. Bringing the mind under control, although I warned early on, I think in the first session, that this very masculine or Purusha Bhava is the term we use, which also refers to women too, because every soul in this material world is thinking they're Purusha, the enjoyer. So this Purusha Bhava approach that I can gain control over my life is very dangerous actually. Because we do not, because the mind is a Shakti of the Lord, and we do not have power and authority over the mind as jivas. We simply do not. So we have to always keep that in mind when, because we use such terms, we read such terms, control the mind, and all that. But it can only really be done through yoga means to link with higher, at least a higher dimension of consciousness, higher power, higher, finally, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yoga means the root is yuj, to link with. So that's the essential sense of it. It's not that you're doing it on your own, but you're linking with the higher power that is empowering you to be able to gain control of the mind. So therefore, when we talk of controlling the mind, there are basically two things, two aspects, the positive and the negative, and these come out here. Bridling the mind, this is quoted from Prabhupada's purport, means the negative aspect, and concentrating on the Supreme Godhead means the positive aspect. Both constitute what Srila Prabhupada here terms the essential point. Says there's an essential point that we have to get as devotees in relationship with our mind. And both of them constitute that essential point. That you can't be a devotee if you just let your mind run here and there and anywhere, you see. Which has become, unfortunately, the outcome of a lot of Western psychology, you know. That there's this theory of repression. And lately there's a theory of repressed memories and things like that. And all kinds of strange things. And then there's an anti-movement called the... I think it's called the False Memory Foundation. You know, because there's psychologists who put people in a state where the mind goes free. It's almost like dreaming. That's what hypnosis is, more or less. You enter into a dream state while still awake, in a sense. And then the mind starts to concoct, in some cases, concocts memories, because that's what happens in dreams. You remember dreams, you wake up, you're remembering a dream, but you know that it didn't happen. It's the mind's creation. So there's some psychotherapists or psychologists who take a woman and lay her down on the couch, whatever they do, and she talks freely, and then they suggest, and could this have something to do with your father? And then she thinks, and then the mind makes connection. Yes, yes, it could. Do you think that your father, when you were young, that he might have touched you in a wrong way? Yes, that's possible. Well, think about that. Think about it more. Oh, yeah. Oh, now I remember. Oh, ah! But it's a totally, you know, then it's investigated, police get involved, and they do a detective, and they find out that at the time she claimed that she was molested when she was 5 years old, the father was in Europe on a business trip. So it's totally impossible. So, there's a foundation called the False Memory Foundation to combat these psychologists, you know. So it's a whole war that goes on. So you can't be a devotee if you just let your mind do whatever it wants to do, create all kinds of connections, crazy, you know, Salvador Dali imagery. You can't allow your mind to do that. Nor can you be a devotee if you don't focus your mind on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So we have to do both. So, dear, yes, I write here, because originally this was an essay to be read, so I write, dear readers, so now I'm saying, dear audience, those of you who are hearing, kindly note carefully that Srila Prabhupada states, the same concentration can be achieved by other recommended processes, therefore anyaischa, other methods can also be applied. So, that's actually why we're having this course. Because we want to present you with not only complete a picture of the mind drawing from the Bhagavata as our wellspring source, and also allied Vedic literatures. Not only that you'll understand what the mind is and what its components are and what its relationship is with the super soul and the body and the senses and the modes of nature and all of that, but also we want to go through different approaches to dealing with the mind. And in my my essay, there's Ayurveda, there's other processes that can be helpful. You see, just like even in modern Western psychology, there are things that are helpful, because I've known devotees myself, unless they take because they have some sort of chemical imbalance in the brain that would normally cause them to act in a very bizarre fashion, and therefore they were not able to serve Krishna. I remember one in Germany, one devotee I knew, he was very nice. Actually, he was my godbrother, and I felt very strongly in my heart for him, very great sympathy, because he was really nice person, you know, and a real dedicated, really, he's initiated by Prabhupada and very dedicated to Srila Prabhupada, but he was crazy. I mean, he had something wrong with his brain, and his brain was producing chemicals that caused psychosis, you know, some kind of psychotic, and it would happen in periods, you know, it wasn't all the time. It would come and go. So sometimes he would just be this bright, he was like a very kind of person with a big smile on his face and a gleam in his eye, and I mean, not a crazy gleam, a nice, warm, and very, you know, nice person and enthusiastic to serve. And then it would just happen. Something would click on his brain. You'd say, Prabhu, because he was sort of only capable, but he liked to do the simple services of the temple, like clean the floor, wash the pots. He was very much a servant type of devotee. So he'd get an assignment, go up to the top floor of the temple and clean, mop the floor there. And then when you're done, come back and give you something else to do. And then a few hours would go by and someone would downstairs would finally, I won't mention his name, where is he? And then someone would go and find him in the middle of the floor, I mean standing there with the mop in his hand, frozen, just staring at the floor. And God knows how long he'd been in that position, just frozen looking at the floor. You see? And once the devotee came down, he used to get up very early, and he came, the shower was in the basement of the temple. And so he came down at 2 in the morning to shower and chant his rounds before Mangalarti. And it was all dark down there, so as he was coming, he was turning on the lights. So he turned on the lights, and then he got to the shower room door where there was the sink also, where the devotees would clean their teeth and then step in the shower. And he opened the door, and that room was also dark. The whole basement was dark. And when he turned on the light, he saw this devotee standing there, looking in the mirror with the toilet bristle brush, brushing his teeth like this, and blood all over his face, and running down his chest. And he had a big grin, and he just looked, in full darkness, he was doing this. But if he would take his medicine, then these symptoms would be abated. And he could act as a simple devotee. He wasn't the kind of devotee he asked to give classes or anything like that. But he could just act, follow the basic program and do service. But the thing that he would get into is that he'd get enlivened by Krishna consciousness, go on a kirtan, come back very happy, and he'd start to think, I don't need this medicine, because it was a hang-up with him. It was sort of an embarrassment, I guess, problem that he had, that I have to take this medicine. I'm not like the other devotees. I can't be just free and liberated like them and just blissful. I have to take this medicine in order to keep my mind. So he would stop taking the medicine, and then sure enough, sooner or later, some bizarre behavior would manifest. So this is a point I want to make, this anyaischa, the Prabhupada says, other recommended. It can also, to some extent, include, because I've seen it myself, things that have come out of the Western psychology or study of the mind, and the brain. However, we have to be cautious for reasons we've already explained, Freudian theory and so on and so forth. But the point is, whatever works, whatever can assist us in controlling, not that we're the controllers, but again, in coming to the mode of goodness, getting that shakti from the Lord by where the mind becomes pacified, stitva sattva prasiddhita, becomes pacified and calm. And we can go on with our devotional service undisturbed, reasonably undisturbed by the mind, that we should accept. We should not be prejudicial. Or, I was thinking of another word. Anyway, prejudicial is good enough. So I wanted to make that point. That's why we're having this class, because we want to sort of like openly discuss these issues. But we do intend to, we're putting, of course, the greatest emphasis on the Vedic science, the Bhagavata science of mind. And ultimately, yes, these things like taking pills, that was his problem, because he knew it's only dealing with the symptom. So what is the actual cure? And that's what we get from Srimad Bhagavatam. The actual cure, the ultimate cure. Like someone once asked Srila Prabhupada, do you know everything? He was a challenger, a person who wanted to embarrass Prabhupada in a public situation. So he raised his hand, do you know everything? And Prabhupada said, yes. Oh, you know everything. Then do you know how to cure cancer? We'd all be very interested to hear what the cure for cancer is. And Prabhupada said, simply chant Hare Krishna, go back home, back to Godhead, never take birth again, no more cancer. And that is the ultimate cure for all these things. So, but we have to get to that point of chanting purely and serving Krishna purely. So whatever we can use to pacify this crazy mind, we should, accept what is favorable for devotional service. Don't be afraid. Don't be prejudiced against it, and end up like this. I really love this person, but he had this problem that he thought there was something wrong as a devotee to take this medicine, and then you'd see he would become incapable of doing anything for Krishna. And when he would take the medicine, at least he could do some simple service and maintain a reasonably sane relationship with other devotees. So I thought that's an important... Do you have any comment on that? You look like you do.
I knew of another example that was similar in America. Yeah. I guess my question was kind of, like you were giving the example of the keyboard, the monitor, and the processor.
Yeah.
In the case that we see, like for example, you go upstairs and poor Vagisha's got his monitor that's got the lines in it, and it's all screwed up, and so and we can say that that's akin to an issue with the brain, not with the computer is working normal. In the case that medication changes brain chemistry in such a way that the monitor works again, is that to say that it's simply
no? But you see, the cause is obviously something deeper, because the taking of medication is only dealing with a symptom. It readjusts. The person still has the problem if he stops taking it. And even when they're on the medication, they're still not fully... I mean, at least I know from this devotee I'm talking about. He was a very nice person, mm-hmm. very lovable person. But even when he was on medication, that was also doing something to his subtle. But you could tell there was still something not normal about him. But at least he could function. So we have to ask ourselves, why is his brain out of kilter? Why is that happening? And that takes us to deeper issues of karma and things like that.
Is it ever a case
that ultimately the Lord is the antaryami, the inner controller of all the functions of the body and the mind and everything. And the Lord has put this person in that situation for a reason.
Is it ever a case that the brain... You get a bum brain, like you get a bum heart sometimes, and you know that's just a manifestation of the corrupted karma. Is it possible that the brain is just not working properly just because of the corrupted karma? There's really nothing deeper.
Karma means something deeper. Mm. Karma means you have done something in the past. Yeah, and that's a pretty heavy reaction to get a bum brain. I mean, Srila Bhaktivinoda Thakur says that insanity in the Chaitanya Shikshamrita, yes, Chaitanya Shikshamrita, that insanity is one of, I think it's seven types, or there's some number of types of serious sinful reactions. So you can't just pass it off like you bought a car and in the factory they accidentally installed a bad crankshaft in it, and you just take it back into the factory and the service center, and for free under warranty they'll replace the crankshaft and you'll be okay. It's not like that. If you've gotten a bad brain, a brain that's for some deeper reason, not producing the right chemicals so that the mind is disturbed, it is indicative of some serious sinful activity that one has performed in a previous lifetime. And now one is obliged to deal with it. Be humble. That was the thing about Harijaksha, that he... his name slipped out. Anyway. Anyway, it's okay. This did make him a very humble and serving type of devotee, you see.
Same as the person I know in America as well.
I think I know. He's in Boston? Yeah, I know him too. Very similar. Very, very similar type of person. He has to take the medication, and then he comes to the temple very enthusiastically and does a service, but you can see, even under medication, there's just something a little wrong there. So he's having to carry the burden of some sin or some aparad. Since he's among devotees, it's very likely an aparad from a previous lifetime. And now he's being forced by Krishna to be humble, to do menial service. He might have been, in a previous life, a very great intellectual type of person who is very dismissive of those who are less intelligent and wanted to be served by others and not didn't have a service attitude towards others. This is just hypothetical. And now he's placed in a situation where he's glad that he can do service, because that's his only connection. He feels that he has to have connection to Krishna devotees, and so he's glad that at least that much is there. He's thankful.
I one time heard Satchinanda Swami say that, you know, that a Vaishnava is not under the, you know, the mechanical rules of karmic reaction, but receives token reactions from Krishna. And he analyzed this word token as saying, token is a gift. When you think of, you know, of what kind of gift to get someone, you think, oh, what could this person use? What will help this person, etc., etc. He said, in the same way, our token reactions are meant specifically for us, and they have a specific purpose in our lives.
Yeah.
I think you can see when people receive, you know, reactions like this that are uncommon, that there is a specific purpose behind it.
Yes. Particularly, especially with devotees. Because karmis go on sometimes, you know, they're getting their reactions, but they don't take the lesson from
right,
it.
But right,
at least
right.
In the society of devotees, those who really want to be devotees, you actually see how the living entity is learning something.
Understand it doesn't happen for no reason.
Yes.
There's
and then adjusting himself.
Yeah.
And that's very good. That's actually healthy. That's moving in the healthy direction. You see. Because ultimately we're all messed up. You know, we're all... You go under the surface, and we're all crazy, more or less, all of us. So we all have to learn to deal with our particular insanity. And I remember Satsarupa Maharaj, I heard him tell this story, and then when he started writing many books, he wrote about it, so I think it's pretty well known now, but that... time when Prabhupada held the first, I believe it was the first or second initiation, you know, either the first or the second initiation in ISKCON. And Steve Guarino, his name was at the time, Bhakti, well, they didn't say Bhakti, I think, Steve Prabhu or whatever they used to say, was invited by Prabhupada to come and be initiated. And at that time his service was typing. He used to type from Prabhupada's audio cassettes. Audio tapes, actually, reel-to-reel tapes, the manuscript for Gita and so on. And so he thought that this is somehow more sincere to stay away from the, you know, the ceremonial aspect and get initiated, and to actually do the service, which is the real, you know, real substance. And so instead of going to the initiation, he was stayed in his apartment, he just typed. And then he met Srila Prabhupada as he was going to his apartment. I don't know if it was right after that initiation or the next day or something. And handed him, and he admitted when he said this with some, you know, there was some sense of pride in him, you know, that instead of wasting my time, you know, in this external ceremony, this is what I did. And Prabhupada, he took it, but he looked at him, he gave one of those, I know myself from being looked at by Prabhupada that way, where he just looks right into the depths of your soul and sees the real person. So he gave him one of those looks and he said, if you love me, I will love you. So what Prabhupada was saying, that this initiation is not just a ritual, but actually establishing a loving relationship with the spiritual master. And therefore, one should act in terms of the loving relationship. You know, just like in the material world, the emblem of love is between young man and young woman. And then there's a kind of etiquette of that relationship, you know, that they, from each side, they're being nice, you know, they're trying to do service and be nice to each other, and there are different modes of, or different expressions of affection and intimacy, which are standard. But if, you know, one day they've made a date to meet on some street corner and go off on a walk, and as they come up to greet one another, the young man hauls off and punches her right in the mouth, knocks her down on her back, and then says, "I love you." You know, like that was his expression of love. They punched her in the mouth. Then naturally she's going to also start thinking there must be something wrong up there with him. Something very strange, because that's not considered to be a normal expression of love, that punch the beloved in the mouth. So that was the point Prabhupada was making. You know, we're giving this initiation as an expression of love, and if you take it, then the relationship is sealed. And if you do something else, even if it's typing, I'll accept it, but then something very vital in our relationship is not being, you know, we're not meeting, it's not being bridged. Therefore, when I heard Satsarupa Maharaj tell this story, he concluded by saying, that was my craziness at that time. Hmm. And it's a fact, you see. This inappropriate expression, it has so much, it's so much evident in cases, like you, so many cases you must have seen. And really, you can really say that's what it comes down to, that the person expresses himself in ways that are just inappropriate. And depending on the mildness or severity of the inappropriateness, then they have these terms, neurotic or psychotic or you know, whatever, paranoid schizophrenia. You know, if a person is always looking behind his shoulders and nobody is there. And because I remember once, I joined in Boston too. You come from there?
I moved there six years ago. I joined in New Jersey.
Well, I joined in Boston in 1971. And I remember we had someone join, because in those days, you know, anyone who walked in the door, that's how I joined. I just walked in the door and said, "I want to be a devotee." "Okay, come on," you know. And there was another devotee, and another bhakta, well, he was not a bhakta, new person, who separately from me, I didn't know him, he also came in the same day. And that very night, he tried to kill himself by jumping out the third floor window of the temple. That's how free, you know, and the devotees just, he broke his arm or something. So the devotee just called the ambulance and he was taken away, you know. And they kept on just, you know, anyone who walked in, you stay a week, then you get shaved up, and you know, and you're 6 months later, you're going to be initiated. You know, that's the way they used to do it. So there was another one who came, and he seemed real sincere. And I was dealing with him. I think I was temple commander at the time, so I had to deal with him. And at first he seemed real sincere, but then I started to notice his behavior started to deteriorate. And he started talking to himself, and he would stand, you know, other devotees, when they're taking rest at night, he would stand up in, out of his sleeping bag and go to the window, and he would move his fingers like this and look out the window and mutter things to himself. And then you would call him and he wouldn't respond, and then you'd shake him on the shoulder, and finally he would kind of notice you somewhat. You know, and then after, you know, we were going on Harinam with him, and you know, it was really, he was acting so strangely. He was finally in the Mangal Arti, he would turn to the side and go away, get away from me, there's nobody there, you know, get away from me. And still the devotees were, you know, like, they didn't give up, you know, keep giving him service and trying to keep him engaged. And finally, his two brothers came. It was very interesting. These two, they looked very much like him, and they were dressed, the two brothers, it was so almost like out of a strange movie. They were almost dressed identically, and they looked very similar, these two brothers. They were sitting downstairs. And they were just sitting like this, and I came down because I was temple commander, so that was one of the things I would do, is some guests come, I would, "Can I help you?" And he said, "We believe our brother is here." And then I noted the resemblance right away. "Oh yes, I think I know who you're speaking of." Yes, last week he escaped from the insane asylum. And the temple was the first place he came, and we just brought him right in and started to try to make him into a devotee. So those are the old days.
So you'll be happy to know that 2 years ago they implemented doing background checks in the Boston Temple. So
okay, 2 years ago?
You're 20, you know, 8 years later.
But inappropriate behavior, you see, that was the thing. It was manifesting in this person more and more and more, and still we were just, hi-bo! You know, let's go and hide out. You know, get away from me. So, a few minutes left. Is something I can...
Do you want to read from my computer? Is there no light there?
No, there's enough light. It's fine. So we must come to the point of discriminating. One thing that we have to do in dealing with the mind as devotees is discriminate between the self and the mind. You see? Which is often very hard to do because the mind is the seat of desires and the mind is the seat of emotions. And as, you know, bhakti yoga, as we will science in a, you know, a scientific way show you later, bhakti yoga is really the yoga of emotions. Because, just to give you a little, here, yeah, I can actually show you on the test that we have, this little test that we give for the, but then I'd be giving away the answer, wouldn't I? So I shouldn't do that. Alright, so never mind the test. But anyway, the mind, as Prabhupada said, goes through three phases: thinking, feeling, and willing. And there is Sanskrit terminology for this, which I'll not reveal now because of the test here. So, anyway, thinking, feeling, and willing. And Prabhupada said this is the sum and substance of psychology. So, what is karma yoga? Karma yoga is the yoga in which the willing, or in other words, the activity, takes prominence. You know, they say this is the most important aspect or function of our personality to deal with, is the willing aspect, what we are doing. And so in karma yoga, you have so many rules and regulations that you have to follow. In jnana yoga, it's thinking. You see, that you have to concentrate the mind, focus it on, you know, study Vedanta, think Vedanta philosophy only, rid the mind of anything else. Like Prabhupada even said, the Vedantists, these mind-body Vedantists or impersonal Vedantists, they turn the page of the Vedanta Sutra, and if they see, you know, even they see a scorpion coming, closer, big scorpion, but they've been told by their guru, now for the next hour, you just read the Vedanta Sutra and concentrate. So they just keep reading, and the scorpion's getting closer and closer, and they keep reading. You know, scorpion is just Maya. It's just illusion. It doesn't exist. And the scorpion stings them. This didn't really happen. So this is jnana yoga. And bhakti yoga is the yoga of feeling. And as I mentioned when I talked earlier about this philosopher Schopenhauer, actually, our thinking and our willing is dominated by our feeling. So therefore, bhakti yoga is the highest yoga system, because it recognizes this truth of the human being, that we are emotional beings more than anything else, more than intellectual, more than physically active. We are ruled by our emotions. Even intellectual people behind you, I've read so much philosophy, and that's, you always discover this, you know, reading books of different mundane philosophers, that behind all the big words, you know, what is it said? Big words, small print, no sales. You know, books of philosophy. Very few people buy them, but you know, if you do read them, behind all these big words and the small print and all complicated terminology and all that, you discover sooner or later the emotional state of that person and why he's writing like that. You discover he's writing against certain things and for certain things because of an emotional attitude he has. So bhakti yoga is the yoga of emotions. And because we're ruled by emotions, therefore it is the highest, the topmost yoga system. And it includes karma, and it includes jnana. You see, they're automatically included because it is dealing with the emotions. So we are emotional beings, and so therefore we have to learn very carefully, understand this subject matter very, very carefully, transferring our emotions from Maya to Krishna. And that requires both this positive and negative side. We can't let our emotions flow towards Maya, towards illusion. And we have to try to channel our emotions towards Krishna. Now we're just reaching the end of our class period. So tomorrow, in an introductory way, we'll begin to talk about how to do that in terms of bhakti yoga. What is the process of doing that? On the one side, stopping the emotions from flowing towards Maya, dragging us away, and then channeling the emotions to Krishna, whom, you know, we all have to admit as neophyte devotees, we're, you know, sometimes or often or even, it seems, when we're really in our dark night of the soul periods, most of the time we're not attracted to Krishna all that much, you see. And actually, that is very important. I was having a very nice conversation with a beloved god brother of mine, and he was saying it's actually by realizing, by getting in touch with that lack of attraction to Krishna, by getting in touch with it, by actually, as I was saying yesterday, it may seem to be depressive and, you know, like lack of self-esteem to just come to this conclusion rather than getting into all the complexities of the mind, which we can never trace out because there are unlimited desires. Although, of course, there are certain main desires that we have to deal with, but they branch off into sub-desires and so endlessly. First of all, we have to confront the root, which is that I hate Krishna. I've come to this material world out of tamishra, primordial hatred of Krishna. And so this godbrother, who is very perceptive and very shastric, he made this point that unless we come in touch with that, then we can't begin to understand how much we actually need Krishna. And because when you come in touch with that, if you're a devotee, then the result is a pain, a deep, deep, deep pain. That, you know, for all of my external glory, you know, of devotees bowing down to me or, you know, respecting me, you're an older devotee, whatever, you know, praising you, for all of that, deep in the core of my heart, I don't really feel like that much of a devotee at all. In fact, you know, like Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati wrote this Vaishnava K, what kind of devotee are you? You know, when you try by your own means, by your own arrogant means to become Krishna conscious, thinking you're better than everyone else, what kind of devotee are you? We all have to ask ourselves that question, and if we can come in touch with that fact, that inner lack of Krishna consciousness at the root of our soul, then that pain will actually help us. Prabhupada said that Narottam Das Thakur's songs are so full, again and again, his songs are full of this lalasmayi, it's called longing. Longing, and yet at the same time he's feeling himself totally unworthy. He's feeling himself a sinner, a fallen soul. And sincerely, he's not just playing a role, he sincerely feels like that. Begging the Lord, please, I'm so unworthy, please don't kick me away from your reddish lotus feet. I deserve to be kicked away, but please don't do it. And there's also this wonderful prayer by the serpent Kaliya, where he's begging the Lord. He said, I'm a snake. So I'm under these modes of nature. I can't control them, but you can. And I want to surrender to you, and I want to be your devotee, but I'm helpless. So it's such a cry of pain. See, realization of our helpless position as tiny jivas. And then we can begin to actually attract the Lord's mercy. Then Krishna's compassion starts to really come down on us. as a wonderful blessing. So anyway, we have to stop here, and we will tomorrow speak on the, you know, it's an introductory. We're reading through an introduction right now. So in an introductory way, we'll deal with the practical means of both bridling the mind and focusing, concentrating the mind on Krishna. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Now we need some light in here. Because I have to deal with...